So the entire once future office just walked in.
What up?
What up? So you guys are welcome to, this mic is actually on. Nick, if you're welcome to bug these guys anytime you want.
Thank you.
Just be very close to the mic.
When you okay.
Do. Yeah, perfect. You sound great. So especially the founders, Nikki and Dunjai, I've known for a while from undergrad days. And so I actually really happy you guys are here because we can only talk about Berkeley a bunch, but actually the trajectory is probably fairly similar-ish in terms of starting off. So I'm sure we'll get to a lot of like personal questions stuff. But so they're a new addition, I think, to the lineup of Food Radio. So thanks for making the time on very short notice.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Wow, Nikki has a nice radio voice.
I think everybody has a really nice radio voice. That's why, like, if you're really close to the mic,
it sounds.
She's actually a really good karaoke singer too.
Get closer.
Oh, she's a really good karaoke singer too.
So we have an hour, so we can put on any song you want.
Not ready for that.
You know,
I think I need a little more alcohol.
So Once Future is kind of a everything design firm, but a lot of focus on like graphic design, brand identity, exhibition design, things like that, right?
Yeah, we think of ourselves as generalists, but mostly we work with clients in the civic, cultural, and mission-driven space. So we'll do anything and everything for those clients. But yeah, that's kind of where we specify.
Just to give a sense, can you talk about any of the projects you're actively working on right now? I know it's always tricky, but like literally, what are you working on this week?
This week? Well, public school has been really on our mind, and we actually are partnering with or working with somebody you just interviewed recently, Amy Chang, on trying to sort of raise awareness and level out the playing field for a public school that her son goes to. So we've been working on a campaign and sort of all these materials that will help Amy and her team sort of go out and speak to her community and to bring awareness and partnerships to the school. So that's been something we've sort of been cranking on this week.
Just for specificity's sake, what does that mean to level the playing field and bring? Why does a public school need awareness brought to it?
So good question. There are two well-known public schools in the sort of West Side Hell's Kitchen area. One of them traditionally underserved, the other slightly more affluent. And as the West Side has become more and more developed, the more affluent school became overcrowded, and so they had to redraw the lines. And now a lot of people who thought that they bought property to go toward that more well-to-do school are learning that they need to go to the other school. And parents like Amy thought, this is a great opportunity. You know, this school has a really storied past. It has a lot of talent and exciting potential amongst the student body. There are notable New Yorkers who have come out of that school. And so why don't we leverage our resources to try and support this school rather than running away? So Amy and another group of parents have formed a nonprofit called Friends of Makers and Artists, who will be establishing corporate partnerships to support the school's new mission around being makers and makers and artists. And they also have a Chinese language learning program that is for all students, not just a specific portion of the population, which is unusual for language learning programs.
This is probably just my ignorance, but are most public schools in New York reliant on private support, financial support?
Unfortunately, I think yes. The stronger your PTA, the better off your school is. So most schools don't rely on just their public funding.
So what was the ask when Amy, I assume it was Amy that came to you about the project, what was the ask at that point before you really knew what you were going to do from a design point of view?
So they already had this really strong mission. They knew exactly who they wanted to be speaking with organizations and corporations in the Chinese cultural space and also around makers and the STEAM movement. They knew that they wanted to present themselves as being really put together, really, you know, like they wanted to put a fresh foot forward that presented them as professional, that that positioned them as being serious and an organization that people would want to partner with. You know, the opportunities and the stories behind the school are all there and they speak for themselves, but they wanted to just say, like, you know, we're here, we're ready to do this, come along for the ride.
And from a how far, where are you right now in that process of the project?
Well, the designs have been approved, and we're waiting for some content, and we're about to probably launch the website in the next month or so. Yeah, it's rolling along really well. Amy's actually doing interviews with exciting artists and makers in the community, and those will be featured in a print piece and also on the website.
Oh, cool. So in terms of, let's say, collateral or deliverables, website's obviously one of them. What else did you make or are you making for this project?
It's a brand identity with a sort of letterhead system, a poster that also folds down into a mailer, the website, and then sort of a toolkit going forward for them to roll out.
I interrupted when you were starting to describe other work, but I have all these questions about this one specifically.
It's a great
or maybe this is a way to get into other projects. How does, because even when you were describing the, what Amy was asking for, kind of the foundations of the material you had to work with from the school and actually what you're producing for them, it sounds very similar to almost any other, in a way, like brand project or commercial project or organizational project. How does it differ your approach? Obviously, I'm sure the design product obviously differs quite a bit, but do you differ in approach because it's a school project or an institutional project versus when you work with a brand?
I think the approach is always really similar, but the outcome differs for sure. So, you know, every designer has a process that they apply to ensure that they get the outcomes that they're looking for that meet the needs of the project. In our case, I would say that we go in listening first and trying to understand exactly, you know, what Amy and the school are trying to achieve. And through a bunch of Q&As and, you know, just hearing what information they've already gathered and who they're hoping to talk to and what they're hoping to achieve, we can better position our work to help them succeed. So if they want to position themselves as being really forward-thinking and a little out of the box, you know, and not, they still want to very much be representative of a grade school, you know, that we're not dealing with upper education here. So it needs to be playful. It needs to look like it's for children. How do we balance all of those desires in one kit of parts?
Yeah, but it still has to speak to the Gates Foundation. So the age group and the audience is so varied, which has been interesting for us. And we sort of see our creative process as making a food dish or thinking about ingredients. So we have ingredients for like kids, but also for foundations that might be donating or partnerships. So it's an interesting project where we're trying to hit all these different. Oh, sorry, I'm not speaking close enough. But
I feel like you're basically like talking at, like, being way too intimate with the microphone.
Just like it.
Yeah,
I'm scared to get too close to this. But yeah, it's interesting because there's, you know, a variety of age groups and audience that we have to speak to.
Dong, what have you done to prepare these microphones for germophobes?
Nothing.
Yeah, I can see that Nikki's really scared.
just invite very clean guests again. No, nothing. Probably should do something. Okay, so what other? This is obviously, it seems like a really impactful, important project. What else? Do you guys work on multiple projects at a time, or do you try to focus on one at a time?
Multiple at a time is sort of our MO.
Yeah. We're always juggling lots of different things. But, I mean, like you mentioned earlier, it's sort of a spectrum of stuff. We just worked on a big campaign with the AIGA New York to get people to go out and vote local and how important that is, to exhibitions with the Museum of the City of New York, to a book for Studio Gang. So it's sort of very varied and in scale and scope, but it keeps it fun, right? I think Drian and Nick are kind of slightly
They're
naughty.
Like,
oh.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys, because in terms of, I think that there's always a big interest, I think, from a lot of designers to be able to do a really eclectic series of work or type of work. certainly in for organizations and in spaces that they're personally very interested in. How, as a general of a question this is, but how do you go about getting work across all those different types of work? Is it mostly they find you and they call you, or is it through tapping up friends? Is it through, do you market it anyway?
They find us and call us, but we're making a more concerted effort to go out and get the work that we want to be doing.
And how? I'm just asking because I think that's always like a question for any young
design
firm.
Yeah, absolutely. Showing up, you know, going to people's events like yours. Mm. Hey, do you want to work with us?
Sure. See, it's that easy.
Yep. No, it's never that easy, but yeah, it's, you know, it's a long process of relationship building, I think.
Yeah.
It got, you know, when we first started out, I would say that nobody ever teaches you how to build business in school.
Especially design school.
No, never. And it took a while for it not to feel like a smarmy sales pitch. It took a while to just find that space where talking about your studio and talking about the work you do and getting others, you know, interested in working with you felt authentic and not like a hard sell. Mm. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're still working on it every day and figuring it out. But I would say 99% of our work comes through word of mouth, friends, the community that we've sort of built around our studio.
But just going out and getting excited about other people's work, too, and what they're doing. Excitement and passion sort of feeds upon itself, and it's, it grows. So, you know, seeing what other people are doing, talking about what you're doing, kind of just opportunities come up. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've found something similar, perhaps?
I mean, pretty much, yeah. And there's, I think that the marketing from a design office or architecture office is never that direct or clear. It is always just kind of like people you meet and, like you said, showing up, I think, just being around.
Yeah. I mean, not everything is the right fit. I'll tell you that yesterday, my dad is a dentist, and yesterday we got an email from my dad who had CC'd his colleague who he's co-teaching a class with next semester, which is very exciting. Go, Dad. Demanding a logo and a price for a logo. And it wasn't even so much of an ask. It was like, give us a cost for a logo. And so, you know, we field things like that too, where it's, you know, it's obviously not the right fit, but.
Did you point into some like clip art?
Yeah, $99 logos. Yeah.
For $50, you can go get a thing.
A lot of the work you do is within the architectural field. Do you think that a deliberate thing, or actually just because you guys kind of were born out of the architectural field?
I think it initially, when we started our studio, it was sort of the world that we knew and our community, and so it's been very natural for us. Nikki is still chasing after polar bears, if there's a polar bear out there that wants to work with her.
Anyone in the wildlife conservation space, I'm your girl.
Yeah, so, you know,
love animals. Yeah. Let's talk.
So, you know, we've sort of, the architecture thing has been natural for us, but we're still chasing after, like, personal dreams, like working with polar bears and other things.
When did you guys start One's Future?
2012? So, no, I don't even remember. Is that bad?
Nikki and I have been working together on and off for the last 10 plus years.
Okay.
So it almost feels like we've been together that long, but sort of doing our own things, but also collaborating. But we didn't make it official until a few years ago.
Do you want to know our origin story?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
I didn't know Dunjai at Berkeley. I knew her husband, or her now husband, Chris. We were in studio together. But Dunjai and I actually connected in grad school, and I was visiting RISD for the first time. She was already a student there in the grad department in graphic design. Both of us had decided we wanted to defect from architecture. And Dunjai's got away with faces. She saw me and she said immediately, "Hey, I know you." And then I was like, "I know her face, but I don't remember her name." So I tried to play it off. I was like, "Hey, what's up?
Who are you?"
And then I was like, I'll figure this out later, you know, no big deal. And then at the point where I was like, "Give me your contact information," and she wrote down her name, I was like, "Fuck, I don't know how to say that." So like the jig was up, you know. Like Dunjai's got a very unique name, and so yeah.
But I saw Nikki's face, and then immediately I thought about her ex-boyfriend. Because I was like, hey, you're the girl who used to date that hacky sack guy. He would walk campus.
Yeah.
He wouldn't walk. He would hacky sack around campus. So that's how I remembered her.
There's probably work in the hacky sack or, like, alternative sports games space. People you know.
Totally.
So what you guys, you said you'd been working together sort of informally for a little while. What prompted you guys to formalize it into one's future or into an office?
You know, I think because we were friends first, we wanted to be very deliberate about the way that we did this. So if we were going to do it, we had a lot of talks about, you know, how is this going to affect our friendship? Are we sure we want to do this? Do we think we'll have a good working relationship? And so we just sort of kept doing projects together. And at the point where I think we had 4 or 5 projects under our belts, it didn't make sense to really not start
like
a studio.
Name to it.
Yeah. I think at the point where you decided you wanted to be independent and didn't want to go back to an in-house job,
yeah,
it just made sense.
So can you walk through that transition of where were you working? What was this in-house job you were at?
I was at Metropolis Magazine for 7 years as the art director there. And I think for me, it was just taking the leap and not, you know, relying on a paycheck and being scared of that leap. And there were just a lot of personal things in my life that happened in 2013 that sort of prompted just a jump.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sort of came out of that year, this was partnership.
When you say a jump, was it like...
It's like I'm just ready to leave and try something different.
But I mean, you were doing work on the side with Nikki?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was always like through my contacts through the magazine, people would always be like, do you know a good graphic designer who could work on this project? And I would always wish that I could work on it. But obviously, it would be a conflict of interest. So.
But that was for like a number of years, it seems like. I mean, if you've been working roughly 10 years together, at least for a handful of years while you were still at Metropolis, you were doing projects on the side together, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you have a similar, Nikki, did you have a similar?
So like, I graduated into a recession. I came out of grad school in 2008 and also out of undergrad in 2002. So
yeah, she hit the jackpot.
I know what it means to be scrappy dong. Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of full time work, but there was a lot of freelance. So I had the opportunity to bounce around. And, you know, we were both entering a career path that was new to us, that, you know, we had shifted gears from architecture and now re-entered the workforce in a field where I didn't know what it was to work as a graphic designer. So it was actually a great opportunity to try a couple things out. I was at the Times Magazine for a while. I was with Project Projects for a while. I got to participate in the heyday of digital design for publications, when every magazine decided, oh my gosh, we could have an iPad app, and our iPad app is going to be better than our neighbors. So they would devote, you know, immense resources and time and editorial support towards specific iPad app, and it was great fun to work on at the time, and then they decided that that wasn't worth it, so everyone sort of streamlined, but yeah, and then after that, I kind of knew I always wanted to do something on my own.
And since you were even for Project Products, for example, you were still freelancing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was it a more gradual kind of turning up of focus on one future stuff and turning down of the third party kind of freelance work?
Exactly.
Or was there like, there wasn't like a deliberate like, here I go, I'm taking a leap?
I mean, freelance gigs they range from a couple of weeks in duration to several months. So they would always be anywhere between 2 and like 2 months in a year. Mm. And during that time, I could sort of pursue other projects on the side, and yeah, it worked out nicely.
Was there a, when you guys were finally both full, did you guys both go full time at the same time for One's Future?
Oh, yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. You did. Were you already kind of up and running as a business at that point?
Oh.
Like, were you like, oh shit, okay, we actually...
Yeah, I mean, we were working on projects together, but...
We had both had our own independent... practices prior to that, so merging was actually fairly easy.
Yeah.
Aside from the accounting side, mm-hmm. you know, and figuring out how to split ownership, we had all of the tools and processes in place.
Was there ever a moment where you thought One's future was not going to work? At the beginning anyway, like as a business?
No, I mean, we came from families that are entrepreneurs, so I think we've always had that entrepreneurial spirit and not being afraid of trying this out, and I don't think we ever thought about failure. Although, you know, it's sometimes you get a little worried or scared when you, especially with, like, the ups and downs of the economy and, you know, running a studio, but I think we've always stayed positive and that something always comes through.
Mm. So a big one is why did both of you make the switch away from architecture into graphic design? I guess we'll start with Nikki.
Well, we weren't very good at it.
At architecture?
Hey, speak for yourself.
I think for me, I came to realize that I loved the education more than I loved practice. ED 120, where they taught us all of the ethics of the profession and how to respond to an RFP and what you needed to know about running a firm.
If any clients are listening, yes, I remember that class completely, but I have no idea.
I remember taking that class and being like, ugh. Is this really what it's going to be like? And then I was like, no, brush that aside. I love making models. I love drawing with my roach rings. And there was more drawing, more craft in the education at that point too. You know, we weren't entirely converted to computers. And even when I was trying to apply for my first architecture job, I didn't know how to draft anything. I didn't know how to use AutoCAD. So that was all learned on the job. And when I came to understand that my role in the profession was more production oriented, I became a bit disillusioned, and I realized that I liked the presentation of architecture more than I liked the practice.
Where were you when you had that realization?
Do you remember ELS in Berkeley?
That's a studio?
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
How can you remember all these course names?
Wait, ELS is an office or a class? Mm-hmm. That's an office.
So I was at an architecture studio or architecture firm in Berkeley.
Oh, yes.
For 3 years after... Okay. I graduated.
What were you working on?
Oh, I can tell you my my great works in the field of architecture. One is a family bathroom in the shopping mall in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The second is the parking lot adjacent to that bathroom.
I mean, you have to get to the bathroom somehow.
Yeah. And the third, I actually just introduced to our office last week, is a snack shack in the middle of two soccer fields in Palo Alto.
Is that still up?
I don't know. Oh. I've never seen it in real life, so someday.
And these were all through ELS?
Yes.
Do you ever wonder if it was you or ELS that pushed you away from architecture?
No, it was never a question. Amy worked at ELS, too.
Oh. Well, she's not in architecture either.
Yeah, true. Oh, good point.
I'm curious because I feel like a lot of people, especially if they're not loving the architecture firm they're in, or the job they're in general, will sort of stick it out and either hope it gets better or kind of get used to the, you know, it just becomes a job or something like that. But that moment where like, all right, I actually need to completely change professions. I'm going to go back to school for graphic design, let alone starting your own company, obviously, down the road. But I always think that moment where like, okay, this is actually just not a direction, no matter what I do, that I need to stick in?
Most of the best decisions in my life have been gut reactions, so I can't say that there was a lot of real thought that went into it. It was sort of a growing feeling over time.
So after like that 3 years, did you directly apply to school and go from ELS into school back to RISD?
I knew I needed a change, so I simultaneously applied to school, thought that maybe I would still be interested in a master's in architecture, but in a more theoretical program. And then I also applied for jobs in New York. And
in architecture.
They all happened at the same time. So I got a job in New York, not as an not on an architecture track, but for a firm in a more office manager role. And
did you take it?
I did. Hmm. It was my ticket out. and then I also got into grad school at the same time. So
oh, okay.
Moved here, met my now husband, and then immediately left.
Nice. That seems productive.
Yeah.
How long were you at the architecture firm here?
6 months. It was short.
Okay. And why did you choose, when you said you applied, did you say you also applied to other grad school, like architecture grad school?
I was going to, and then by the time those applications were due, I was done with the graphic design ones, and I was done with applications, so I stopped.
Okay. Had you had experience in graphic design before that, before going back to school for it?
Not other than just sort of recreational things, like a poster for a friend's play or a poster for a sport event.
Do you remember at that time, was it in the things you'd been sort of like playing around with, the poster for the sport
event?
No
one can ever see them.
Nikki
just showed we'll us her them. First logo she ever designed last week.
How was it?
It was amazing.
Can the dentist use it?
No, you can have it was inspired by Sputnik. So you can have a tooth like shooting out of the Sputnik.
Oh yeah, we got all kinds of
there's probably not a lot of like space themed dentist offices. I guess the curious because like grad school is not a small commitment. Do you remember at the time where you're like, all right, this is actually a shift in career, or was it just, I like this, I'm going to try it?
It was, I like this, I'm going to try it, and without any real regard for the financial future of that, which is terrifying. Like, the money is just abstract at that point. Mm-hmm. Oh, someone's going to give me a piece of paper that says I'll pay it back later? Great.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I don't think I can really endorse that for others.
In Dungey, after Berkeley, because you also had the same bachelors of art and architecture through Berkeley, right?
Yeah.
Did you work at a firm afterwards, or did you jump immediately out?
I worked for a firm, but it very much felt like a job.
Where at
that point? At. Oh my
god. Also I can't ELS. Even remember.
It was not ELS.
You're really digging into the recesses of our memory.
We're only just getting started.
I totally have mommy brain this morning.
What city was it in?
It was in Berkeley.
Okay.
It was for a professor. Buchanan Associates.
Okay.
I love my bosses. They're awesome. They're actually still my mentors now. I think that at that point, it felt like a job. And at night, I took random classes in product design and graphic design, and then I was like, this graphic design thing is really fun. And that was sort of
you said you were already taking classes at night after your
work
job.
Yeah,
why?
I don't know, because I was one of those weird annoying
well, also if your work is not
satisfying,
fulfilling, there's creative energy left over. I took classes too.
How long were you there at Buchanan's office?
3 or 4 years. It was a while. Yeah.
Do you have a similar sentiment where you just needed an out, or were you more committed to, I'm going to shift professions?
I think at that point, like, all of our friends and colleagues were applying to grad school. So I was like, well, I think maybe this is what I need to do too. And I started to look into architecture schools and graphic design schools. And then
we sound so flippant, like, you know, like, we just sort of followed along this path because
I know.
Other people.
Well,
were
you
doing
don't really
it.
Know what you're doing in your early 20s, and you sort of just.
Or do you, Nick?
Yeah, I've got to figure it out.
Nick is.
Nick's just playing the. No. When is your exit, Nick? When are you leaving? Just kidding. We'll get to that in a minute.
Wait, exit from what? Do I know? Do I not know something? That
you should offer him a job on the air.
Shit. He doesn't know yet.
Yeah, so I was sort of with Nikki, too. I applied to all these graphic design schools, and then I was like, I would go to any of these shittiest graphic design schools on this list over any architecture school. So I was like, why would I waste my time with the application? So I just sort of stopped there.
Mm. And so your position at Metropolis was after RISD.
Yeah.
Was it deliberate again, I guess, that you were working on a publication that was about architecture? Like, were you trying to find a job, let's say, that had a foot in architecture in some way, or that just actually kind of worked out?
That job actually sort of, in a way, came to me. Like, the last year in grad school, the head of our department was like, hey, the CD at Metropolis is looking for somebody to work for him. And is anybody here interested? Because this guy used to be my intern back in the day, and now, you know, he's looking for some recommendations. And I raised my hand and I was like, you know, I'm interested. I actually started working for them before I even left school in a way.
Bitch stole my dream job.
And so it sort of just happened. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something I was looking out for. I actually didn't even really know what I was going to do. And it just all sort of worked out in a way.
Could you ever, because you spent so much time in the kind of publication world, do you guys ever have interest in starting your own publication?
You know, we hadn't thought about it until now. Do we?
Do you? What I mean, do you have interest in the kind of, I mean, because you said you made a book for Studio Gang's office.
We love publication design, but I think coming up with the editorial vision.
It's a lot of work, you know. Like when we, obviously the magazine is sort of this string that we've been, or tie between our history, because it was the coolest thing to work for 10 years ago when we left grad school. Everybody went to work for a magazine. But, you know, those are really well-oiled machines. It's a lot of work to sort of try to start it out on your own, I think. And so that
it's also, they're not money. I mean, it's funny because we've actually had a couple people that now run magazines. Mm-hmm. And A, it's actually amazing how much magazines connect people to other people, like people that have worked there or come across it. Like Fader is one that a bunch of guests kind of related to in some way. Pinup is another one that a lot of people kind of came through and related to in some way. But there is that underlying theme was also like, you don't get into magazine publishing if you want to make any money, for one. Yeah. But also it's really interesting to hear about like some are well-oiled machines, some are just two guys like fucking around and actually somehow putting out an incredible publication.
Yeah.
But it's amazing, actually, like, because I'd never thought of magazine as a community, like magazine community as a community, that there was all these people that ended up tying themselves to other people or meeting other people through magazine work, which is kind of interesting. Yeah.
And that, I mean, I love that community, too. I would be totally open to starting a publication with others, but do we want to start it from the ground up ourselves? I don't know. Pretty happy with just running a studio.
Okay, so now... jumping even back before, like, do you remember
when we were born?
When you were born, that first few minutes. Actually, we haven't gotten that far yet with anybody. We'll see if we get that far. But even the
I have been thinking about when I was born lately.
Have you?
Have.
Why?
Sorry. It's mostly actually has to do with politics and sort of, am I really an American lately? Actually, because. In the Trump, I was actually born. My parents were illegal when I was born, and I actually was talking about this to Nikki the other day. I was like, "So am I, you know, an American citizen?" But in Trump's world, I would not be. That's kind of been on my mind lately. Like, am I really an American? Hmm. Just thinking about my birth and
where were you born?
I was born in California, Los Angeles.
Are you also from California?
Nope, Oregon.
Oh, I knew that. But it's West Coast. I feel like that's good enough. when did your parents immigrate here?
They came here in the early 70s. They actually became green card holders because of the Reagan amnesty in the early 80s. Mm. So for a big chunk of my early life, they were sort of living illegally and hiding, sort of. Yeah.
Where'd they come over from?
Both from Thailand. My dad came on a student visa and never went back, and my mom came on a tourist visa and never went back.
That's amazing. Did they know each other before coming over?
They were married.
Oh, they were.
Yeah. And they actually, it was really hard for them to come here because they actually left. They had two daughters, my two older sisters, who they left to come here to find a better life for everybody, or the American dream, which I've also been thinking about a lot lately. and so we sort of never went back.
Do you know if that was, have you talked to them about like when they first came here under their visas, was that their plan to not leave?
Yes. Hmm. It was very much planned.
Mm-hmm. And what do they do, or what did they do? Are they retired now?
Yeah, they're retired. They're, you know, my mom's really busy with her grandchildren and running around picking them up and dropping them off. We sort of just built a huge family out here.
In New York?
In the U.S. Yeah.
What did they do professionally before they retired?
All my life, my parents owned a liquor store. In New York, I guess they call them bodegas. And that was sort of the thing. And then they dabbled in real estate because of the money they saved up and bought apartments and houses that they rented out. That's sort of where the entrepreneurial spirit comes from when Nikki and I talk about that a lot. And they always just took risks.
So they are full on like American dream models.
I would say so. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you get a chance to talk to them much about that transformation is not the right word, but that kind of push from coming here, I'm sure, with anxiety about not being able to stay here to the point where they actually created a foundation for a huge family to kind of blossom in the U.S.? I mean, that's a huge... It is literally like a storybook. I've only heard it for 30 seconds now, but like it sounds like the trajectory is everything you'd... The whole reason why you would take that first risk in the first place to bring yourself in.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was younger, I asked a lot of questions. Now it's just sort of, a known thing in our family history. But I was very curious. They actually, I can talk about it all day, but they came here illegally and they were deported back.
Oh, they were?
And they came back with a different name.
Wow, that's incredible.
Well, same name, different spelling.
Amazing.
They just kept trying. I mean, they were deported once, but yeah, it was worth it for them to leave their family and to keep coming back.
Were you already born when they were deported?
I was born the second time they came back.
Okay. So with you questioning the kind of your birth, I guess, it's amazing. We've actually never talked about birth times, but it is true, like, especially with it being November 7th and like everything that's been happening yesterday and this whole 2 years, I guess. But do you feel American?
I've always felt American, but honestly, lately I question that. And I think that's, why it's on top of my mind right now as we're talking today. But yeah.
And you have children now as well, right?
I have a daughter, 4 years old. So then I question, is she American? Mm-hmm. we are, but I'm just thinking about all the things that are going, all the conversations that are happening in the world right now is just makes me question everything.
Sorry, Nikki, I'm very curious about Tanjay.
We can talk about Nikki's birth too.
We will, hopefully, maybe. I mean, I was always curious, like, maybe for both of you, did you guys grow up in ethnic or immigrant communities? Like, what was your neighborhood like? What was your school like?
I grew up in Long Beach, California, which is a pretty diverse, I think, city. It's actually the second largest city in L.A., or a county in L.A. But there was a big Southeast Asian population, and there still is. So there's Thais and Cambodians and Laotian, Hmong people. But on the flip side, there was this super white, affluent, also community. So there's and it still is till this day. But my parents decided to stay there because of the Thai community out in Long Beach.
Are they still out in Long Beach?
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, the reason I'm so curious about this, besides it being a really compelling story, is also just the, especially with immigrant kids and Asian American kids, the idea, I think, of starting something on your own and running something on your own is usually not that forefronted. It may be, I'm curious if it's actually very different because your parents had actually driven their own direction basically from day one, it seems. Did you ever, was it always... I think you mentioned before, but the idea of starting something on your own, was that always something you wanted to do?
I think so.
It was for me, for sure. I mean, it's just ingrained in us, I think. Watching my dad run his dental practice, I grew up in his office, either, stamping and filing charts or running amok in the back, but cleaning bloody teeth off of trays.
Like the idea of running a business was not foreign to you, I guess.
No, not at all. But I grew up in, I think it's you know, it's a really good question for Asian American youth now. What opportunities are there out there for entrepreneurship, or, you know, or for even thinking beyond what thinking creatively beyond what you see as a possibility for your own career trajectory?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is so white, and it remains so white. But in the 80s, it was just...
Extra white.
Yeah, and, you know, my first language was actually Mandarin, but when my brother entered kindergarten, he started having trouble in school because he didn't know English very well, and so that's when we started speaking English at home. But I don't remember not being able to communicate, and I don't remember that anyone thought that I didn't speak their language.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what that transition was like from speaking only Mandarin to then speaking only English, and now I've lost all my Mandarin.
Really?
Yep, it's all gone.
Your parents then try to, like, force it back into you at some point?
They tried. My mom tried so hard, and then at some point she was like, fuck it, I'm done. You'll regret this, and I do. So.
I imagine your high school was very white?
Super white. And so it wasn't actually until I got to Berkeley that I really felt seen. I think that for the most part of the first 18 years of my life, I was trying to be not Asian.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember having, because what's amazing, I guess, is having parents that in some ways were models for not only running your own business, but actually just finding a way to carve out a life for yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, my dad he's second generation. He was actually born in San Francisco, and his parents were immigrants. But there's this whole generation of immigrants who really felt that assimilation was the way forward, mm-hmm. that in order to succeed in this country, you had to adopt the national language and sort of let go of the trappings of your cultural history.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely, but that at least you put on a public face that shows that you are one
right.
with the rest.
Well, I mean, it's just, it's a cultural thing. I mean, as well, I think in terms of the U.S. being a place where individualism is certainly promoted and you're sort of expected to be your own sort of standout person, which in many other countries, especially Asian countries, that's not the point at all with being part of a civic place.
Right.
So, I mean, did you guys have any people in any sort of creative field, let's say before Berkeley, that you were like, oh shit, that musician, that painter who looked like you, you're like, oh, actually that's something I could do. Besides the notion, I think you can start something on your own, but certainly moving into the creative arts or finding that you can actually make a career out of that. Was there anybody that you looked up to at all?
I think for me, it wasn't anybody famous, but my uncle, my father's brother, was an artist and a professor. And so I always sort of admired that, you know, in an Asian family, that he was allowed to create art. and I was artistic since I was young and always wanted to draw and paint and do all these creative things. And so it was always supported in my family, and which is kind of rare for an Asian family. But so I was always, yeah, it was always not questioned for me.
And did you both apply to Berkeley in architecture?
I did. I think I attended a career fair at some point during high school and thought, someone from an interior design firm came. And I was like, that looks interesting.
To your high school?
Mm-hmm. Mm. I've always loved color. Mm. You know, they were getting to experiment with patterns and textures and color. And that all sounded really enticing, except I couldn't find any schools that I wanted to go to that had interior design programs. So architecture felt like a tangential step forward.
Mm. And you had mentioned you didn't really feel like you belonged until Berkeley.
Or at least I didn't really acknowledge my Chinese cultural heritage. Until college.
Did you like dive into it when you were at Berkeley? Did you join organizations and clubs and stuff?
It was actually more at the end of my time at Berkeley. I joined a Chinese dragon boat team.
No way.
Yeah.
Nikki's had some really interesting experiences.
I've gotten to paddle in races in Western China.
Wow. Wait, like recently, or that was part of the college team?
No. A long time ago.
Like competitively?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, it was more recreational, right. But there was a race.
Are there dragon boat clubs in New York?
There are, in Queens.
There are? Where do they practice or paddle?
Good question. I'm going to guess like somewhere along Jamaica Bay, but don't quote me on that.
Berkeley was not majority Asian when we were there, right?
I think it was like 30% Asian.
I was like 30? Oh.
Yeah. Where are we at now?
I feel like at some point they got to like 55.
Yeah.
But I don't know where they are now, actually. It certainly felt like a shit ton of Asians when we were there.
Yeah.
More than any place else that I'd been in my life. But you'd come from like a community, like a very Asian community, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
So was Berkeley not that different for you, or was it actually still, like, contextually, what was it like to be amongst all those Asians / all those white people at the same time? Because I follow like Nikki's trajectory, where that was the first time that you were actually in a world where there was a ton of Asian people.
Yeah, I guess my transition was more. It felt natural. Yeah, because all my classes were always mixed with 30% Asian and the rest Caucasian. So, yeah, it didn't feel that weird to me.
Do you find it all of it? Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, I did notice all the Asians at Berkeley, though. There's a lot of them. But it wasn't a shock.
Do you guys find it all that now, where you've established kind of successful practice, that your Asianness is at any of the forefront of your thought when you work or approach your practice?
I think there are times that we're self-conscious about how we're perceived by others, especially when you're going up for large competitive bids, right? Mm-hmm. There was one time where we applied for a city job and we were directly asked if we would be capable of handling the big personalities in city government.
At the DOT specifically.
Do you think that was asked because you're Asian or because you're a woman?
I'm going to guess it was a combination of both. I mean, we're petite Asian women. There was actually this Microsoft app, shitty tool like most Microsoft things, that came out a couple years ago, that if you took a photo of yourself on your phone, it would predict your age. And so, you know, I made the rounds, and at a party one night, some friends were like, oh, this thing's so accurate, it's uncanny. And I was like, give me that. And as you might predict, it shaved 10 years off my life. So I've been carded for alcohol recently, even though I'm closer to 40 than I am to the legal drinking age. You know, it's very hard to tell from our appearance the level of experience that we have. And so sometimes people make assumptions, and it's something that we contend with, but that we try not to define the way that we work.
Mm-hmm. How do you overcome that sort of perception of people? Do you not think about it when you kind of pursue
tall shoes and glasses?
Yeah, I used to put on glasses, even though my eyesight is pretty much...
I got LASIK. 20/20. I don't even need glasses anymore. So if you see me wearing them...
glasses?
Yeah, that's our little secret for this radio community.
I mean, that's also maybe part of a question, especially with you guys being... your office being somewhere between 5 and 10 years old, I guess, that you're still a young office, and you're still, I'm sure people are still seeing you as a kind of new design practice, and inevitably, obviously, having questions about capacity and capability.
Yeah, it's interesting what defines young anymore. I mean, we share an office with architects, and when
that bar for architects,
young is in your 40s, yeah. Right? Like your mid 40s. Mm. I hope to retire by then.
I think we're old in Nick and Rianne's eyes.
So this is, I think, the first time that a full, like, an office has been here. People that work with you are here watching you talk about your birth and stuff. do you guys have any questions that you want them to answer live, recorded and on air that they can't take back ever? Well,
yes, I haven't thought of any yet.
All right.
But
grab the mic anytime you do.
All right.
Yeah, I'll chime in.
All right.
These guys get stories all the time. We have lunch together a lot, and there's always a round table of stories or whatever is going on in pop culture.
Yeah, for anyone running a practice out there, I highly recommend team lunches. We learn a lot about each other. And also, eating at your desk is really, really sad.
It is very depressing. Do you see the kind of work you're doing changing? And actually, Amy, I think, mentioned it a couple weeks ago that you're focusing especially on working only with clients or collaborators that have potentially like a social mission or a political mission or environmental mission of some kind.
I'd say that's a large part of our work. It's not entirely our work, but when we feel good about the project, I feel like it gives us extra energy and momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You won't see us doing any work for Pfizer anytime soon.
Even
Philip Morris, probably not.
Is that depending on the paycheck or no?
Well, yeah, never say never. No, that's probably a never.
That's good.
They could pay me a lot of money and I still wouldn't want to work with them.
Has, Nikki, you don't have children yet, do you?
Nope.
Has becoming a mom changed how you approach your work, Dunjai?
I feel like I try to be a lot more efficient.
Mm-hmm. she was already efficient, but...
Just because, you know, my days are a little shorter because I have to run out the door at 5:30 to pick her up. But other than that, like, yeah, efficiency. Hmm.
Has it changed at all, like, what you value as good or bad work?
I think it definitely helps us in terms of thinking about, like, what we want to do because, you know, we are spending time away from our family to work, right? That's what we all do. And so we think about, like, what is it that we really want to work on? And is this exciting enough to take on? Or, you know, as a business, we're always sort of gauging it through that lens.
There's an excitement that comes from being around a kid, too, who's discovering things for the first time.
And she's in the office a lot, right?
Oh, yeah.
She's like a big fan of Nick.
She's actually the office creative director.
So I have one more question for them. If you guys had anything, do you have any questions that came to mind yet? No. All right. You still have like a minute.
We got it all out at lunch.
Yeah. and I guess this is for both of you, because I guess you guys started working on your own projects before obviously starting One's Future together. And so the question is basically, when did you guys make your first dollar independently from being hired by another company? Like on a project that was yours?
Was it Andy's logo?
Yeah. We worked on a project for Andy Bernheimer, who used to be the other half of Della Valley Bernheimer, and Jared.
Oh, yeah.
Della Valley, who then went on to Alloy, and then Andy sort of continued his architecture practice with Bernheimer Architecture. That was our first sort of logo identity.
This was as One's Future already, or this is, no?
This was independent. Dunjai was still working at Metropolis, so she was burning the midnight oil.
Mm. Yeah, this was our first side project together.
And we now, I mean, they're longtime collaborators and friends. Now we share an office with them. Almost. Not quite 10 years ago, but yeah, 8 years later.
But was that the first time either of you had made a dollar money for your own work? No, you guys had been doing stuff on your own before.
No, we've been scrappy for years.
Do you remember what, like Nikki, do you remember what your first like project was that someone paid you for your own work was?
Give me a moment. I got to really, really dig in the back of my memory.
Like first dollar ever? mean like doing chores at home or...
Mostly, I guess it's like...
I cleaned a lot of bloody teeth off of trays.
it's like, what's the first dollar? We're like, oh, shit, I can actually... There's a business in the thing I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I'm sure at that point, you're like, I'm going to make a shit ton of money. But it's like someone was like paying you for the thing you wanted to do anyway.
My first graphic design dollar was designing a book for an NYU professor.
How'd that come about? Like, did you... Yeah, how that
came about. I was interning at actually the Yale Press, and there was, I guess this project was too small for them, so they asked me if I wanted to take it on my personal time, and that sort of became my first job.
Mm. I honestly can't remember. That's so sad. I'm thinking of all those like framed dollar bills that people put on the wall when they start business. I don't know where mine's from.
But my first dollar was cleaning my family's bathroom.
Oh, didn't you get paid to iron shirts too?
Yes.
For your family?
25 cents a shirt. I was very good at ironing.
I never learned to iron.
Still no questions? Wow, you guys really have talked about everything.
I was going to say, I feel like we talk about everything all the time.
Do you have any questions for Nick?
So many
can't.
Questions.
Why aren't we on your Instagram story?
Well, you are right now.
Oh, we are. Yeah. We found out about a month ago, because, you know, Nick always posts some really cool stuff and people would talk about it in our office, and we're like, hey, we don't see anything. And
we've been
turns
blocked.
Out we've been blocked.
Probably a smart move.
Now we're making him embarrassed.
Well, it's hard to come into the office. Like if I'm running late, let's say I'm running like 10 or 15 minutes late.
It's because he was doing a story.
If I'm like posted a video. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. Yeah. I'm glad you guys have come at such short notice.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for inviting us, Tom.
Yeah.